Hello, and welcome to episode 115 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine in Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. How are you this morning, Bill?
I'm doing great, Seth. Ready to go feet wet, as you say, when you're flying out from the land of Guadalcanal back out over the ocean. So feet wet.
And we are definitely going to be discussing that today. The month of August 1942 has had its ups and downs so far as the campaign for Guadalcanal is concerned. The invasion of Guadalcanal, Tulagi, Tanambogo, and other outlying islands in the area initially went very well. Marines occupied the islands rather quickly and eliminated Japanese resistance to a man in most places. On August 21st, Marines from the 1st Marine Regiment utterly destroyed the first major Japanese counterstrike on land at the Tenaru River. On land, the campaign was succeeding. At sea, however, it was not. The debacle at Savo Island, the worst defeat in the United States Navy's history, left a bitter taste in the mouths of every person in and around the seas of Guadalcanal that wore an American or Allied uniform. Because of the defeat at Savo Island, among other reasons, Admiral Fletcher pulled his precious carriers away from the immediate vicinity of Guadalcanal to preserve their ever so valuable flight decks. However, because of the Tenaru battle, Fletcher was compelled to reverse course and send his flat tops back to the waters of Guadalcanal to protect and support the Marines against any further Japanese efforts ashore. And believe me, there were more Japanese efforts ashore that were certainly in the planning. Unbeknownst to Fletcher, the Japanese had deployed a strong naval force under the command of Chuichi Nagumo of Midway fame to support Japanese land efforts and destroy any U.S. ships in the area. Over the next few days, that being August 24th, 1942 specifically, the U.S. fleet and the Japanese fleet groped for each other and eventually became entangled in the third carrier battle of 1942, what history would call the Battle of the Eastern Solomons. So this is going to be something that kind of repeats itself for almost every single major Japanese counterstrike that happens on Guadalcanal. It's a combined arms. And I mean, a former skipper of the in the United States Navy knows full well about combined arms. Can you just lay it on us real quick, Bill? What are the Japanese doing here? The term of combined arms factors so heavily into every single thing that they do from now until they pull out of Guadalcanal in January. Can you just lay it on us here? What are the Japanese doing?
Well, both sides understood almost the prime directive of ground campaign operations. In any war that supported where the forces have to transit over the sea, that in order to control the land, you first need control of the seas. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, that happened at Midway. You know, Fletcher was at Midway, embarked in Yorktown. Yorktown isn't here. Mm-hmm. I can't remember why, because it was sunk at Midway, right? And so, and Fletcher, despite being the commander at Midway, much of the glory goes to Spruance, who, after Yorktown was sunk, and Fletcher shifts his flag onto Astoria, you know, in essence, Spruance is in tactical command and gets a lot of glory. Now, here in August, that was June, in August of 1942, Fletcher has another opportunity to get it right. Now, we got it right at Midway. I don't want to minimize that.
For sure.
But in order to do that, and in order to protect those Marines ashore, he needs to maintain command of the seas. Mm-hmm. And in the old days, it would have been the surface combatants, battleships, and other things that would have done that. But now, carrier warfare is firmly entrenched in both sides. You know, Nagumo's forces and Fletcher's forces know that they need to control the seas. And so both are going to posture, but to make sure that happens. In Nagumo's case, he wants to retake what he might have thought was lost command of the seas, because we were able to land on Guadalcanal and Tulagi so easily, something almost called, in at least on Guadalcanal, not so much on Tulagi, an administrative landing, which is means an unopposed landing. So in Nagumo's mind, we must have had command of the seas in the local area, at least, in order to do that. And he wants to deny us that. So his is as much a sea denial mission as it is a sea control mission, and they're not the same thing. In Fletcher's case, it needs to be sea control. And that means recovering from the shellacking we took at Savo and making sure that that doesn't happen again, and making sure that his carriers not only support the Marines ashore, because we did have ground-based aircraft operating out of Henderson Field at this point.
Correct.
But also make sure that he doesn't lose the only three carriers at this point we have left in the South Pacific.
Right. And, you know, that's 100% right. And the Japanese also, as you said, Nagumo is aware, or Yamamoto really, is aware that, you know, obviously, you know, this is August 24th now, you know, word doesn't reach back to Yamamoto about the destruction, the full destruction of Ichiki's people immediately. It does obviously get back to him. And the Japanese are sending a troop convoy under Admiral Tanaka. I cannot remember his first name, his last name is Tanaka. Yeah.
I don't either. Yeah. I'm not the historian here. You are, Seth.
This one slipped out the ear, like I was saying before.
That's okay.
But Tanaka is leading a troop convoy to Guadalcanal to reinforce what is left of the Ichiki detachment. What he's bringing is actually the second echelon of the Ichiki detachment. This is what Dave Holland talked about, you know, that Ichiki was supposed to wait for before he launched his assault, but he decided he wasn't going to do that.
And at this point, they're still trying to move these forces in with regular old troop transports, right?
Correct. Exactly. And this is why these events set up in the way that they do, is that this troop convoy or troop transport convoy under Tanaka is heading towards Guadalcanal. The Japanese are fully aware that we have air power on Guadalcanal right now. And it's not to the extent that it would, it's not even close to the extent that it would be later on in the campaign, but we do have aircraft there.
The Cactus Air Force is still quite small.
Very, very, very small. And it's very tenuous, but we got birds on the ground there, and they can and will do damage to the Japanese.
Mostly during the day. Absolutely. That's true for the carrier air forces as well, but go ahead.
Absolutely. But to support this troop transport convoy that's coming down, Yamamoto puts his old friend, I guess you'd call him a friend, Nagumo, in command of a carrier task force.
Who's also at Midway.
Right, right.
So and Nagumo and Fletcher again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right, yeah, facing off again.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, divisional rivals in a football game. But he sends these carriers down there. He sends actually quite a lot of ships down there, Yamamoto does, to support the troop transport convoy going down there and destroy any shipping, American shipping, that's in the area. Now, Nagumo actually did not have any firm grasp as to where American aircraft carriers were, but he was not stupid. He was fully aware that there had to be carriers operating in the area, American carriers operating in the area. And of course, you know, Yamamoto is and always has been and always will be obsessed with this decisive battle. Yeah. You know, John Parshall talked about this at Midway. Mm-hmm. You know, he's obsessed with this. And the Japanese as a whole really are obsessed with this decisive battle mantra in their minds. And this is another example of that. He's deploying quite a lot of ships in the area to both protect that convoy and also to destroy any American ships that may be in the area that he knows figures probably are at some point.
So this is kind of the third consecutive carrier battle. We had Coral Sea, where the only Japanese carrier that was sunk was a light carrier.
Right.
And we had Midway, where four fleet carriers were sunk. And now we have what's going to be referred to as the Battle of Eastern Solomons. Two fleet carriers, Shokaku and Suikaku, which were Pearl Harbor veteran carriers, and a light carrier, Ryujo. But why weren't Shokaku and Suikaku at Midway? I don't remember.
Well, if you recall back at Coral Sea, Shokaku got hit. She got hit pretty bad. Got hit pretty bad by
kind of like the Yorktown did on our side at Coral Sea.
Yeah, but it was actually even worse because her flight deck took a significant beating at Coral Sea. Shokaku did significant beating at Coral Sea, such to the extent that she could not operate as an effective aircraft carrier. So she had to.
We talked about this in Midway with John, but enclosed hangar decks of the Japanese characters caused the maelstrom when you got a bomb dropped through the flight deck into the hangar deck to conflagration inside that enclosed hangar deck compared to what happened when American carriers got hit.
Right.
More on that later.
And she took a pretty good beating there.
Mm-hmm.
Shikaku did. But she was still afloat. And Zuikaku lost a whole hell of a lot of air of her air group. She had a lot of human casualties.
Right.
And so neither of them were able to participate. Neither of them were able to participate in Midway. However, a lot of the survivors, you know, it's a misconception, and we talked about this in our Midway mm-hmm. episode too, that all the Japanese pilots. Aviators at Midway were killed. That's not true.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the guys that were rescued out of the water at Midway are flying off of Shikaku and Zuikaku here at this battle right here.
They cross-stacked.
Right.
And really, you know, we talk about the miracle of getting Yorktown ready after mm-hmm. Coral Sea for Midway. Mm-hmm. They really did something similar here with these two carriers, didn't they?
They did.
With Shokaku and Zuikaku, getting them ready for the Battle of Eastern Solomons. And Yamamoto was vigorously, passionately set on kicking the Americans out of Guadalcanal at this point.
Absolutely.
And in fact, at one point, I don't remember exactly when, even the emperor gets involved motivating the Navy and the Army to take Guadalcanal back.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, if you look at the deployment of the Japanese forces for this battle, it is eerily similar to the Battle of Coral Sea. It really is. Mm-hmm. And go back and listen to episode 107, because we're not going to go through all Coral Sea here, but just dig on this for a second. Aside from the fleet carriers that we just talked about, Shokaku and Zuikaku,
two of them,
there is a light carrier, Ryuo, as you just mm-hmm. said, and they're split into three forces. The advanced force is what it was called. Under Admiral Nobutaki Kondo, had five heavy cruisers, one light cruiser, eight destroyers, and a battle wagon.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was another force called the Vanguard Force under Admiral Hiroki Abe, consisted of two battleships, three heavy cruisers, one light cruiser, and six destroyers. And then on top of that, the Japanese mm-hmm. also detached Ryuho, and she was actually ahead of the main, well, you could call it Kitabutai, because that's exactly what it was, just to a lesser extent, the main carrier striking force. So it's eerily similar to the disposition of the Japanese forces at Coral Sea. And there's a lot
and
of things
course,
that happen.
Of course, Coral Sea, it's the light carrier that gets the whacking and gets sunk.
Exactly. And as you'll see, there's some things that are very, very similar here.
Yeah.
So now Yamamoto's plan called for the destruction of the American carriers if they were there, which, of course, he knew they probably were. He figured that by destroying the American aircraft carriers off the shores of Guadalcanal, that would compel the United States to pull all their naval forces back, which it would have, and would have allowed the Japanese to basically have free reign of the seas. You talked about control of the seas. This is it. They would have been able to shell the bejesus out of their Marines in and around Henderson Field, and they'd have been able to land their troops, you know, whenever they wanted to, which for all intents and purposes, they did. But they did not succeed in the actual, you know, destruction of the American carrier forces here, as we'll see. There's a couple issues with the Japanese, the way they divide their forces here. One is that by dividing their forces, this is to the negative side on there, they deplete their anti-aircraft capability here.
And the Japanese keep doing this, right?
They do.
They make this mistake over and over and over again because it's that convergence of hundreds of guns, literally hundreds of guns,
right,
if you count each barrel,
from
all of these battleships and other and cruisers, and putting all that lead up in the air has a great effect on not just the combat air patrol from the carriers, on defending the fleet from incoming aircraft.
Absolutely. And if you look at the disposition of the United States task forces, if you pull it up and you look at a map, now the two carriers that are going to be involved in this action are Enterprise and Saratoga, and they are separated from one another, but the way
Wasp was there too, but what happened to Wasp?
So there were three carriers. Like you said, there were Saratoga, Enterprise, and Wasp, CV-3, 6, and 7. 7, Wasp is actually detached. Fletcher detaches Wasp the day before the battle because she is critically low on fuel. She's got to get out of there. She's got to go refuel. So he detaches her and she misses the battle. And that flight deck and those airplanes could have been
the old saying that amateurs talk tactics and professionals talk logistics.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an example of why, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If he had better managed the refueling and rearming and resupplying of his three carriers in advance of the battle, he would have three carriers available to him, not two.
He could have. And, you know, you could, if we really started digging deep, you know, we could say a lot of different things about why Wasp was detached. She was a smaller ship. She was a smaller aircraft. She wasn't nearly the size of Enterprise, or certainly not Saratoga, and therefore didn't have the fuel bunkers that those two carriers did. And then two, John Lundstrom had mentioned something when he wrote his book about Fletcher that, you know, in his defense, essentially in a defense. Yeah, that, you know, the Navy, the U.S. Navy was fighting some pretty significant winds and different weather aspects that caused the carriers to have to steam at a very high rate of speed in excess of 25 knots for a very, very long time, and therefore burned more fuel, and Wasp happened to burn it a little faster. So, you know,
and
it
for is the what it people is. Who haven't operated in the Navy, if you double your speed, you actually triple your fuel consumption rate. So it's nonlinear. So by going that fast, they're consuming fuel at a very, very high rate. It's even worse on the battleships than it is on the carriers.
And they are sucking it down too. Now, to counter any Japanese movements in the area, the United States essentially had the exact same force that they started the Watchtower with, minus, of course, the four cruisers that were sunk at Savo Island. We had the three carriers that we just talked about, and Wasp is detached. So for now, she's gone. She's no longer part of this operation. So we're talking six and three, Enterprise and Sarah. But Fletcher splits his task forces into two, and they're all under his command. Task Force 11, which is centered around Saratoga, has an escort of two heavy cruisers and five destroyers. That's all she really has, because that's all we had in the area. Task Force 16, which is Enterprise, is centered around Enterprise under the command of Admiral Thomas Kincaid. And we'll hear from Kincaid in later carrier actions throughout this campaign.
People will remember, if they listened to our earlier episode, we would have had at least four more cruisers had we not gotten whacked at Savo Island, right?
Absolutely.
And so we're dealing with that.
We're dealing with a lack of guns in one task force, which was Saratoga's Task Force 11. And we're dealing with a bit of a different episode over here at Task Force 16, because Enterprise is escorted by one heavy cruiser, one light cruiser, the anti-aircraft cruiser Atlanta, which is a beast. It's just nothing but weaponry, and six destroyers. However, a conspicuous presence among Task Force 16 is the fast battleship USS North Carolina, BB-55. This is the first time that North Carolina is going to see any kind of action. And this is also the first time that the fast battleships, and there's a difference, and I want to classify this so people understand, you know, you say fast battleships, so what the hell is the difference between a fast battleship and a battleship?
These are not the kind of battleships that were sunk at Pearl Harbor.
Correct. Because those battle wagons that were sunk at Pearl Harbor, those are all pre-war, you know.
World War One.
Yeah.
And basket masts and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. These are old battleships, and they could do 21 knots going downhill with a tailwind.
Yeah.
These guys, North Carolina and the succeeding, you know, Washington, South Dakota, Alabama, Massachusetts, Indiana, all those guys, and then of course the Iowas much later, they can all do 26, 27 knots. You know, some of them
almost
can do
keep up
with
the carriers.
Yeah. So, but significantly faster. And you say six knots, and that's not that much. It is.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, that's a hell of a big deal when you're talking about. So these are the fast battleships. These are the newest battle wagons that the United States has at its fingertips.
And remember, the carriers not only need to keep that speed for transit, they need window of the flight deck to conduct flight operations. And to do that, they need to go fast. And the last thing you want to do while you're conducting flight operations is leave all your screen and escort ships behind.
So kind of defeats the purpose.
That's why that six knots is important.
So, and it's true, and Bill, again, you'll know this better than I, but a task force can only move as fast as its slowest ship.
Yeah.
So that's why the big battle wagons, the old ones, that's why they're still off the West Coast.
North Carolina has a nickname, as I recall. Do you remember what that is?
Yeah, they call her the showboat.
Why is that?
The showboat. Frankly, I don't know.
No, I think because it was new and impressive. And probably. Everybody would go aboard her after she was new construction, after she was built, to show off what these new battleships were like. And so, yeah, she's picked beautiful. Up the Yeah, she is. Yeah.
And she's still afloat, too, by the way. Mm-hmm. She's in Wilmington, North Carolina. Go visit her if you haven't had the opportunity to do so. But the thing is with the fast battleships is that you're going to see over and over and over again, especially here and later again at Santa Cruz when South Dakota enters the fray, is that these things are festooned with anti-aircraft weaponry. And this is actually even before the introduction of the 40 millimeter Bofors guns that are going to be all over American battleships later on in the war. Yeah. But still, just a lot of lead that these things
and those are quad mount 40 millimeter guns, right? Four barrels that you're aiming at the same time.
Right. And just a far superior weapon to what's on the ships now. But still, it's a lot of guns. A lot of guns. Let's move forward to August 24th. August 24th is when the defecation hits the ventilation here. beginning on August 22nd, both United States and Japanese forces start sending out search aircraft in order to locate one another. Again, now nobody knows where anybody is. Nobody even knows if there's anybody coming, but it's assumed that Japanese are coming, that the Japanese are going to send aircraft carriers. The Japanese assume that we have carriers in the operation, so they're out hunting for one another. Fletcher is sending out searches from Enterprise and Saratoga, almost said Yorktown, but from Enterprise and Saratoga. You know, each day the one carrier is called what's called the duty carrier. And that carrier has responsibilities for searches and inner air patrols and combat air patrols and all the other stuff. And the other, that other carrier has a day off. Well, he's doing this repeatedly as the forces are closing in on one another. But the thing that he's relying on mostly are PBY Catalinas. Those who listen to our midway episode will remember that the PBYs were the ones that first spotted the Japanese carriers and the invasion force coming in. Now,
is Mark Mitcher in command of these patrol wing at this point?
He is not.
He's not. Is it McCain at this point, the ground force commander?
Overall, McCain is in charge of this operation.
This and is Senator McCain's grandfather for those that are trying to keep track.
Right. And for his failures from Savo Island, his people really do a good job here because they the PBYs do indeed spot the Japanese coming in. They spot the Japanese transport convoy. They spot the Japanese combatants coming in. Specifically, they're looking for the carriers, which they do locate Ryuo, but at a later date. Early on the morning of the 24th of August, Fletcher is aware that the Japanese are out there. The PBYs have spotted the convoy coming in. They've spotted some of the combatants. But he had not spotted what he knew to be out there, which were the fleet carriers. He was kind of holding back. And if you recall, too, you know, Fletcher, he kind of, it wasn't really his fault, but he sent the kitchen sink at Shoho based on the intelligence that he had received from a SBD pilot named Nielsen that said he had spotted two Japanese carriers. And it was actually thinking that it was Shokaku and Zuikaku, or at least at the very least two fleet carriers. He sent everything and it was actually just Shoho. So he was a little gun shy.
May have been influenced by his memory.
Yes.
That at Midway, the Japanese kept all four carriers together. So he might have assumed that they're doing the same thing here. So if he sees one, the others are going to be nearby somewhere.
Yep. And he was, and you know, you can't blame the man because, I mean, he lost his mind on Nielsen when Nielsen came back and said, oh, hey, by the way, that report I said it sent in was actually wrong. It's only a escort carrier. And he sent the kitchen sink at this. So
after this escort carrier.
So he's holding stuff back. He knows that the Japanese are coming. He knows that they're out there. The Japanese, you know, are aware that we're in the vicinity. The Japanese are sending out what we called snoopers, which are basically scouts, you know, searchers trying to find our aircraft carriers, trying to find our fleet. And they are consistently getting shot down by our F4Fs, our Wildcats that are flying combat air patrol. They're picking them up on radar. The FDOs are actually doing a really good job here. They're sending our people out there to go intercept them, and they're shooting them down. Around 12:40 on August 24th, Fletcher is starting to get itchy. You know, he's starting to get a little nervous, Nelly, little ants in the pants here. He decides to send off 22 SBDs to search from CV6. She's the duty carrier.
Enterprise.
Yeah. He sends off a ton of them out there in 180 degree arc to go find where the hell the Japanese are.
Enterprise was at Midway. Yes. And so these are all very experienced pilots, I would assume.
Some of them are, some of them aren't. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the combat aviators from Midway that were aboard Enterprise in Scouting 6 and Bombing 6, the older, off, and I say older, the more senior officers were pulled out. And
they were already rotated back to become instructors.
Exactly. So a lot of the guys that are aboard CV-6 now flying from the flight deck, mm-hmm. are, some of them are veterans. Actually, I should say this. A great many of them are veterans.
Yeah, but
a
so lot the NCs, JG too. Pilots, they're not senior enough to become instructor right. pilots. So they're still aboard right. Enterprise. The right. lieutenants and maybe a few lieutenant commanders, not the squadron commanders, I would assume. Maybe some squadron commanders were pulled back to the States to train other people how we won the Battle of Midway.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But even then, so we got to remember, we've lost Yorktown. Mm-hmm. We lost Lexington. So we have these air groups, these carrier mm-hmm. air groups, many of which have combat experienced pilots in them. We're not just going to let them sit on the beach.
We're cross-decking them just like the Japanese were doing.
100%. 100%. Yeah. So a lot of the guys that are on Enterprise now, and Saratoga for that matter, are like VS5, Scouting Squadron mm-hmm. 5 is aboard USS Enterprise right now.
And normally you would change the name to Scouting 6 if it goes aboard Enterprise, because CV6, Scouting 6. Yeah. But these guys were, it was a squadron straight off of CV5.
Exactly.
So they kept their designation as Scouting 5.
Exactly. And these are guys who were at Coral Sea, and we're going to talk mm-hmm. about one of them here pretty quick. So he says, Fletcher sends these scouts out, these SBDs out, to visually sight the Ryuhuo. And I should mention too that the PBYs did spot Ryuhuo first, and they radioed the last known reporting location to Fletcher, and he knew that the Japanese had a carrier out there. But again, he's still looking for the big girls. He's mm-hmm. not looking for the little sister. He's looking for mama. And that's why he sends his SBDs out there, not only to hopefully find the fleet carriers, but also to have his people lay eyes on mm-hmm. Ryuhuo, so he can send out a deckload strike that he's having held in reserve aboard USS Saratoga. Mm-hmm. One of the search pilots is a guy named Bernie Strong. And we're going to talk about Bernie Strong here, and we're going to talk about him in several episodes as we progress, specifically Santa Cruz. Bernie Strong was, like most naval aviators, he was rather confident in his abilities, shall we
cocky?
Say.
The yeah, word's cocky. But
just a bit. But the dude could back it up. So this guy was a combat veteran from Coral Sea. You know, we talked about the combat veterans. He is one. Mm-hmm. He flew from the deck of the Yorktown at the early hit and run raids, the Leyte and Salamaua raid. He mm-hmm. On the Tulagi raid, he also flew from Yorktown and helped sink the Shoho. And I believe he might have been credited with a hit on Shokaku. I do not recall, but I do know he was credited with a hit on Shoho. So this guy's got skins on the wall. You know, he yeah. knows what the hell he's doing. He knows, you know, how to get things done. He's assigned the scouting area from 320 to 340 degrees off the Big E's bow. This is his mm-hmm. area. He reaches the flight deck and he goes to his rear seat gunner and he tells him, he says, it's our fight. And this is the direct quote. He says, quote, it's our job to find the Japs, and I know exactly where they are. We're going to get there, circle them, report on their position before they find us. End of story.
It's a great objective. Let's see if we can do it, right?
End of story. He climbs in the cockpit, fires that sucker up, and off he goes.
Mm-hmm.
Fletcher is keenly aware of his mistake at Coral Sea. You know, we talked about this. This is a lot. It's kind of like a mirror image of Coral Sea.
Mm-hmm.
When he sent a deckload strike from two CVs at Shoho, he's hesitant to do the same. This is why he sends all those birds off of Enterprise to go find and visually lay eyes on his targets. He also thinks he's been sighted by the Japanese because of the numerous snoopers that have been shot down. At this point in the battle, or coming battle, I guess you should say, he has not. The Japanese do not know where the hell he is.
Well, they should, though. I mean, at this point, yes, I acknowledge that a lot of their planes got shot down, but it's interesting that none of them reported back.
Well, so he does eventually get spotted by the Japanese. Mm-hmm. Right around 1340, Fletcher, I guess he can't wait anymore. He's like, all right, damn it, we know where at least one target is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to send everything I have from Saratoga only, mind you, to go hit this target. So he holds back his Enterprise, his potential Enterprise strike, And granted, a lot of SBDs from Enterprise are already in the air, and they're armed, by the way. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these SBDs are in the air, but the TBFs and you know everything else from Enterprise is still below decks. And potentially, once the scouts return, they could be rearmed, refueled, and that would be Enterprise's deckload strike for when they mm-hmm. find the Japanese fleet carriers. But regardless of this, he knows where one target is, and he's like, to hell with it. Let's go get the damn thing. Maybe we'll get lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So and he by launches. The way,
I don't blame him for doing that at this point.
Absolutely it's not.
Based on the way the Japanese behaved at Midway and Coral Sea, it's perfectly reasonable what he was doing.
Absolutely. And the thing is that he knew he had at least one target mm-hmm. that he could knock out. So the strike that he sends off is a pretty damn big strike off of Saratoga. It's 29 SBDs, mm-hmm. 8 TBFs, Avengers, and no fighters. And you say no fighters again.
These obsolete Devastators are replaced by Avengers at this point?
Correct. Yes, they are gone. Mm-hmm. The Devastators are devastated.
They were devastated at Midway.
Yeah, they're relics now. Mm-hmm. So the fleet's torpedo bomber is the Avenger, which it will remain for the remainder of the war. It's this strike is under the command of a gentleman named Commander Don Felt. Felt had not seen a whole hell of a lot of action, but he was a very, very, very experienced naval aviator. He was, mm-hmm. he knew his business. He was very calm, cool, collected guy. He wasn't, he would not go off half-cocked. Mm-hmm. And this will come to play here in the next couple hours, really, as we go through this.
Was he the CAG or was he, he's a commander. That's a pretty senior guy.
Yeah. He's CAG.
He's CAG.
Okay. He's CAG.
Carrier Air Group Commander is a... And all the squadron commanders work for him then. Okay.
So Enterprise searchers had been groping for hours, seemingly, for a target for over an hour, actually, when it finally, at 1440 hours, just as he had predicted, Bernie Strong visually sighted the carrier Ryugo. He literally flew, you know, we talk about some guys have a compass in their nose and they just know where the hell to go. And like, you know, John Waldron at Midway,
mm-hmm.
Bernie Strong knew exactly where the hell to go, and he made a beeline for this sucker, and he found it.
Didn't do anything to suppress his ego when he was right about where he'd be. But you know, obviously, very glad that he was right.
Oh yeah, for sure. And this is an issue that is going to come into play huge is throughout the day too. There was some sort of atmospheric mess. Mm-hmm. in the air that day to where radio communications, and this is something that you can explain far better than I, Bill, but radio communications did not reach their intended target. And if they did, a lot of times they were garbled. They were unclear or just
heck, even in the 1980s and 90s, we struggled with high frequency communications because it has a lot to do with, you know, the ionosphere and the radio waves skip, and it creates shadow zones. So you could be transmitting perfectly well, but if there's a shadow zone where the receiver is, they're not going to hear you.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You know, and they can be not very far away from you. If they're in a shadow zone, they're not going to hear you. And this is happening all day. And I'm pretty sure there was some ionospheric, you know, tomfoolery that was going on here with God, you know, playing tricks with the ionosphere. So
something's going on because it plagues the U.S. Navy all day. All day.
It can't just be a guy on the wrong frequency. It has to be kind of atmospheric.
And that's the thing is it's like five or six different guys spot different things, as we'll see, and they make their report. And it doesn't get there. Or if it gets there, it sounds like somebody talking to, you know, they don't, what the hell is it? Nobody knows what that is. Bernie Strong has his radio operator in his back seat, send out the contact report at least six times because he's waiting on Enterprise to acknowledge it.
Acknowledge.
Nothing happens. Mm-hmm. He is forced to circle this Japanese task force for a full, I believe, 7 minutes.
Making sure that the radio report gets out.
Finally, Enterprise sends back acknowledged that they, we heard you. We know where it is now. And Strong says, job done, turns around and leaves curiously. And this guy is, as I said, he's confident as all hell. And he's got skins on the wall and his aircraft is armed, neglects to make an attack on Ryuo. And, you know, I've read a lot of books about naval aviators and specifically 1942, and nobody has ever actually understood why. He did not, because he had the opportunity. Ryuo did send up some AAA. You know, they knew that he was up there, but for all intents and purposes, he still had the opportunity to attack, yet he never did. So he brings his bomb back.
Was he by himself?
Yeah.
He was by himself. Okay.
He was by himself.
Well, yeah.
Well, no, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. I'm wrong. He had a wingman with him. I do apologize. No, he did.
Two ship.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but still, he didn't make his attack. And this is something that haunts him for a good 2 months. So this is August 24th. His next action is going to be October 26th, the Battle of Santa Cruz. You know, I'm not telling you something you don't know here. Right. And he will see action again. And this is something that sticks in his mind for the remainder of this time, because he's actually badgered by the Air Boss aboard Enterprise. John Cromlin basically says, hey, you know, what the hell? You know, why didn't you do this?
It's hard to be cocky when you've flown back with your bombs still aboard.
Yeah, it's a curious set of circumstances that happens here. But nevertheless, it does. It does happen here. At about 15:10, just so less than an hour later, another Enterprise scout, this time piloted by a guy named Yogi Jorgensen. Great name. Of VS-5, spots Ryuo again. This time, he does elect to attack Ryuo. So this is kind of weird. And this happens again at Santa Cruz, where we send out these scouts from, you know, whatever carrier happens to be operating at that time. This time it's Enterprise. And they're armed, obviously. And we make these like single little like pinprick attacks, as opposed to these huge, you know, killing waves.
Coordinated.
Which does happen, but it's kind of strange. It's from the naked eye to the untrained observer, it's very willy-nilly. It's very unorganized.
Well, and again, if we can roll the clock back, we did much the same at Coral Sea. We screwed up any attempt to do coordinated attacks at Coral Sea. At Midway, again, we had an opportunity to do it right, but we had the torpedo bombers coming in by themselves and getting decimated. Uncoordinated waves of airplanes coming in that we were lucky to get done what we got done.
Absolutely.
It's a little bit better here, but it's still not where it needs to be, is it?
It is not. And Commander Felt, to his credit, does execute a pretty decently well, you know, coordinated attack on Ryuo, and we're going to get to that. As Yogi Jorgensen, again, best name in the whole squadron right now, as he's departing the area, let me get back to what I was saying. He does elect to attack Ryuo, but he is driven off by combat air patrol. So he tries to get down there and do his job, but the cap makes him beat feet and get out of there. Well, he gets out of there. As he's leaving the area, he runs into, literally smack into, Commander Felt's strike group coming in.
The other way.
And he gives Felt the latest, hottest dope as to exactly where Ryuo is, because he just left her like 5 minutes ago. He tells him exactly where Ryuo is. Felt acknowledges the transmission, because, I mean, they're literally visually passing one another, so there's no ionospheric screw up here. And Felt readjusts his route, if you will, and decides to head towards Ryuo. Finally, around, I'll say I had the wrong time here, about 15:20, a VB-6 scout pilot, piloted by CO, commanding officer of Bombing Squadron 6, Ray Davis, finally spots the fleet carrier Shokaku. So these guys, remember, I said a big 180 degree arc off Enterprise. He finally spots Shokaku. He radios its position. This is exactly what Fletcher had been waiting for. He radios his position, and he and his wingman elect to attack the big flat top below, but they miss. Regardless of this, he and Robert Shaw miss their target by a mere 30 feet, and he radios the position of Shokaku back to Fletcher, and they never get it. They never get the message.
This is not Robert Shaw of Jaws fame. This is his wingman, Robert Shaw. Yeah, got it.
Exactly. But he finds the treasure, if you will, the treasure chest, does exactly what he's supposed to do, sends the message back. Nobody ever hears it. Note that message never gets back to Fletcher. It's, again, this is this communications issue, the ionospheric flub that basically ruins this whole portion of the attack, because Fletcher had been waiting for this news. What theoretically could have happened at that point had that message going through. And by the way, Commander Felt never heard it either, who was airborne and was in the area. He could have shifted his target and very easily could have attacked Shikaku. He never heard it. So Shikaku, as we will see, and the lack of opportunity that's presented itself here by to the U.S. Navy does come back and haunt us here just a couple of minutes. Yeah. What neither pilot knew at that moment, Shaw or Davis, is that Shikaku had just finished launching a deck load strike against the American aircraft carrier groups. They had been spotted by the Japanese, by one of the snoopers that did not get shot down, had been spotted, and the information had been relayed back to Nagumo, and he sends off a strike from the aircraft carrier Shikaku to go attack what is known to be at least two American aircraft carriers in the region.
So Japanese comms were working better than American comms.
For whatever reason, yeah, right now they were getting the messages, they were sending the messages. We just couldn't get them.
It depends on frequency selection. Mm-hmm. So when you've got one of these shadow zones working up, if you change the frequency, maybe it didn't work on one, it'll work on the other. But in order to know which frequency it is, you've got to test. You've got to kind of prepare before you go into operations begin. And it's, you know, I don't think they knew enough to try to do this. And it could have been random. Mm-hmm. The Japanese were on the right frequency, which made their communications effective, and the Americans just happened to be on the wrong frequency and wouldn't know it until they discovered that they're having trouble communicating.
Exactly. And it's just one of those instances where the gods of war mm-hmm. were not
they get a vote.
On our side. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were not on our side. Let's shift back to Ryuo now, because there's a lot going on in the air at the same day.
Ryujo?
There's a Ryuo, Ryujo.
You're pronouncing it right.
I don't know.
I pronounce it the way it's spelled, which is a mistake in some cases.
So as they're closing in again, you know, it's heartbreaking because Felt could have, he had the power to kill Shikaku had he heard the message, but it's not his fault. He didn't hear it. He didn't know where the hell it was either, any more than Fletcher did. Regardless, he does know where Ryuo is. He's got her visually in his eyeballs right now. He can see that little carrier in his windscreen. And he sets up a coordinated attack at 1536 hours. The attack is pretty well executed in terms of hits and misses. Mm-hmm. Felt sends 21 SBDs to hit Ryuo, which is overkill. However, as we'll see, and I remember John talking about this, you know, you figure a very small percentage, you know, about 10% of the aircraft you send are theoretically going to hit that flat top. And that's almost exactly what happens here. He sends 21 SBDs to hit Ryuo, along with the 8 TBFs that were also a part of the strike. The first fistful of SBDs missed, like completely missed. Ryuo is small, so she's obviously smaller than the fleet carrier, and she's also pretty maneuverable. She's getting the hell out of the way pretty quickly. She's turning and twisting around, you know, pretty good, and she's throwing off the aim of these SBD pilots. And she seems to be getting away from the SBD strike. She doesn't seem to be. She is getting away from the SBD strike. There's no seemingly here. Sid Bottomley, who flew with Bombing Squadron 3 at off the Yorktown at the Battle of Midway, who's now in the same air group here with Don Felt.
On Enterprise.
Technically he flew from both at Midway, Yorktown and then Enterprise, once Yorktown was flight deck was damaged. Bottomley's with Felt's group flying off Saratoga
now. This time.
So he's a Midway vet. He's very, very experienced. He notices pretty quickly that Ryuo is getting away. Now he was assigned to attack one of the heavy cruisers that was also part of this formation, but
that was a secondary target, right?
Correct.
Assuming the carriers got hit.
Correct. He looks over and he sees Ryuo is not hit, and he's like, and he takes his people behind him. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And he goes after Ryuo, and he's among the last group, because he's coordinating his attack, he's among the last group to dive on Ryuo. He chased the ship to almost suicidal level, low level, before he drops his bomb. It's estimated he dropped his bomb around 1,100 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, he was determined.
Yeah.
And I mean, you got to remember, You know, these things are doing 250, 260, 275 knots, just depending on how much he's got poured on, and diving, you know, 80, 90 degree angle. So he is cooking, and then he's got to pull out of this dive. And the SPD was a fantastic airplane. Exactly. And the SPD is a fantastic airplane, but I mean, there's only so much it can do. It is, it is an airplane. So regardless of this, he pulls out at the last second and does, of course, score a hit. He he throws his bomb almost dead center in the flight deck. It explodes, and it's essentially a killing blow on that little bitty carrier right there. Right behind him is Roy Eisenman, another Midway veteran. He hits her again, as does Commander Felt. Commander Felt is the last guy, one of the last guys to dive. He's up in the air watching everything go down. As the Ryuo is hit a couple times, he says, all right, now it's my turn. He goes down. He scores a hit. So Ryuo is hit by at least three bombs that we know of, and that is pretty much going to do her in. But they're not done. She was
torpedo
a fire.
Bombers, the Avengers come in.
Exactly. And this is kind of a little bit of payback for some of the guys here. She's a fire. Ryu is a fire, smoking from under her flight deck when VT-8, and yes, VT-8, this is the reconstituted Torpedo Squadron 8, approaches in their TBS. One of those pilots is Midway veteran guy we talked about, personal friend of mine, Bert Ernest. Bert Ernest and Harry Ferrier. Well, Harry Ferrier is not a part of Bert Ernest's crew at this time anymore, but these are the two guys that flew the Adventure into combat for the first time and then returned to Midway Island with their airplane shot full of holes. Well, and Bert gets a chance.
But again, they had been flying Devastators before this, and now they're flying Avengers.
Well, Bert had been flying Devastators initially, and then he was with VT-8 detached on the island, flying the Avenger for the very first time in combat on Midway. Okay. So this is his first chance he really gets to line up on a Japanese aircraft carrier. It's not known who hit her. She was hit by at least, Ryu was hit by at least one torpedo. If you look at the way the squadron was aligned when they come in, it's about a 75% chance that it was Bert Ernest's torpedo that hit Ryuo, but it's very hard to tell because one torpedo hit her in the starboard side, another torpedo passed just underneath her starboard side stern and just literally passed underneath it without exploding. It was just right underneath.
Went too deep. Yeah.
So who was it? We don't know. I personally would like to think that Bert got a little bit of revenge there, but who the hell knows? But that one torpedo that did hit, and that's unmistakable, it did, which for an American torpedo, this is a big thing.
Yeah, they weren't working very well, remember.
No, they were not. No, they were not. The one that did hit her wrecked her engine room, and it basically killed off her steering, and the ship is done for. You know, Ryuo is done. As she's last seen by American eyes, she had drifted to a stop. She's a fire from stem to stern. She's got a 25-degree list to starboard. She's going down. She's dead. This is the sixth Japanese aircraft carrier that the United States Navy has sunk in 1942. And curiously enough, it is the last one that the Japanese, or that the Americans sink until 1944.
Yeah, there are many reasons for that. 1943 was a dry rear.
Yes, it was. And there, we'll get to that point in the war for sure. But but there's a reason for that. So the strike by Felt's people is successful. You know, they absolutely devastate Ryuo. She's going down. They pull back. The losses for the American side were very negligible. I mean, this was a very successful aerial attack by U.S. Navy Air Forces here. This is a good job. You know, they do a really, really good job. Casualties are light. They get back to Saratoga intact. They land, you know, they do their job very, very well. However, in the air at the same time, if you recall what we were talking about, Shikaku had launched her strike against Enterprise. Well, she'd launched her strike against the American aircraft carriers, which one they were going to hit, you know, God knows. But as they're nearing the formation of American ships, Saratoga happens to escape. She is not visually sighted by the Japanese, but the Big E is. The Japanese pull up on Task Force 16, and at 16:32 hours is when the time was, the radar, the CXAM radar, aboard CV-3, even though she's outside of visual range, reports, quote, many bogeys range 88 miles bearing 320 to Enterprise. It's abundantly clear that these bogeys are coming in to attack the Enterprise air group, or the Enterprise task force, Task Force 16.
Now, bogeys are unidentified air targets, and when you confirm them to be enemy, then they become bandits.
Exactly. Exactly. So in order to repel this pretty good size assault from the Japanese, the Americans launch every fighter, damn near every fighter they have. They launch 55 F-4F Wildcats to take on this inbound strike, which is a heck of a lot of airplanes to take on a strike. And it's rightfully so. Unfortunately, the radio issues that have been plaguing the United States all friggin' day do the same thing here. Only about half of those 55 American fighters actually are able to engage the Japanese.
They get vectored, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Because the damn radio communications are just crap. I mean, they really are. They're crap. The FDOs are doing their best job to get these people where they need to be, but the fighter pilots aren't hearing the messages. And, and when the messages are actually being relayed, the fighter pilots are so friggin' excited that there's so much radio chatter going on that some of the FDO vectors aren't heard, even if they do make it to their
respective targets. That's called radio discipline, right? To make sure that you're only saying what needs to be said to conduct the effective fight. And we talked about this before, the fighters have to operate outside a certain bubble around the ships, because then the ships are going to be firing AAA up against enemy aircraft, and you don't want to be shot down by an American ship. So the fighters engage out beyond AAA range. And then once the bandits, the enemy aircraft, close to within AAA range, the fighters have to disengage to keep from getting shot down themselves. Now, that didn't always happen. Fighters did chase bandits inside AAA range, and sometimes even got shot down by American guns. But that's kind of the theory of what should have been happening.
And it, and if, you know, you said a perfect radio discipline. There was no radio discipline amongst the fighter pilots that day, or at least not very many of them, because had they been able to hear the messages, those few that were being sent out, you know, who knows what would have happened. Regardless of this, about half of the American fighters do make their way to the Japanese. What combat air patrol does get there, and like I said, it's about half, maybe a little bit less than half, get over there, they absolutely wreck the Japanese. I mean, these F-4Fs, while it's not the best fighter in the world, they are putting a licking on the Japanese. One of the guys that does this specifically is Enterprise fighter pilot named Don Runyon, R-U-N-Y-A-N, Don Runyon. Runyon is a former enlisted pilot. He's one of the few that are surviving from that era. And he at this point is now an officer, but regardless of this, he's a combat veteran himself. He's got 4 kills to his credit. And in just a matter of mere minutes, and this will show you how, you know, some of the highly experienced American fighter pilots, of which Runyon was one, perform, even though their F-4Fs are not anything close to the performance zeros. Level of zero, in the hands of a skilled pilot.
They later, the Hellcats are a much better match, but the Wildcats weren't a very good match.
No, no, they weren't. But in the hands of a good pilot, they could
be. 44 kills.
Well, claimed? that's what they claimed. That's what they claim. The Combat Air Patrol claims 44 Japanese kills. The actual Japanese losses are 25 shot down. Still, that's a 43% loss rate. That is significant. That's damn near half your force.
And how many did we lose? Five, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was a 5-to-1 exchange ratio, man. You can do that all day long.
All day long. All day long. And Don Runyon himself gets 4. He gets 3 vowels and a 0.
One short of being an ace.
Yeah. Well, he does eventually get it. He chased another 2 vowels away. So he gets 3 vowels and a 0. He chases another 2 vowels away and damages another. So, and this is, and I'm talking like 5 minutes. So the American fighter pilots, when they are able to engage, they perform exceedingly well.
Highly skilled.
Highly skilled. Despite the successes of the combat air patrols, such as they were, only half, less than half actually get there, the Japanese do penetrate the fighter umbrella. They do get into the airspace of Task Force 16. Some of the valves do slip through. And it is at this time, and this is just cool, it is at this time that the fast battleship, you'll remember I talked about the battleship North Carolina, this is where their real value to the fleet is shown for the first time. Their vast anti-aircraft weaponry is, it's incredible. Enterprise is up at the front end of the formation, and she is hauling ass because it's abundantly clear the Japanese are coming for her. She is cranked out 30 knots. She might have been pushing 31, 32. She is moving. And North Carolina's got, you know, for all intents and purposes, the throttle to the firewall. She's doing as fast as she can. She's going as fast as she possibly can, gliding along at the back of the formation at about 26, maybe 27 knots. But the Big E's pulling away because Enterprise is like, the hell with this. Yeah. We got to go. We got to move. We got to do what we got to do.
That's right.
So when the Japanese strike force appears overhead, North Carolina prepares to fire. And this is incredible. Her anti-aircraft power is awesome. And there is no other word to respond to this. There's no other word to describe this. Lieutenant Commander John Kirkpatrick is the gunnery officer in charge of the anti-aircraft weaponry aboard North Carolina. At his fingertips are 40 50 caliber machine guns, 40 20 millimeter Ehrlichs, four quad 1.1 inch mounts. Again, this is before the Bofors.
These are not the Bofors, right?
Right. Yeah. And 20 5 inch dual purpose mounts. That is a lot of lead.
And that's kind of in reverse order of range, right? So people would say the 5 inches fire first and the quad and the 1.1 inches. And then by the time the 20 millimeters light off, you know, it's pucker factor time because the airplanes are getting close. And of course, those 50 cals, they're like point defense. They're very, I mean, you got to be within eyeball to eyeball distance for those suckers to work. So
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. As the Japanese line up over Enterprise, and you got to remember, North Carolina's trailing, but she's trying. They're out there rowing. They're trying to get her out there as fast as they can.
Yeah.
Kirkpatrick orders commence firing. All at once, whether they can reach the target or not, due to their limited range of 50 calibers, 20 millimeters, everything opens fire at one time. Kirkpatrick is actually
rattled. This is not smokeless powder.
No.
Right? So there's a lot of smoke and powder, you know, going off, basically surrounding the ship.
I can't even imagine the amount of noise, and neither apparently could Kirkpatrick, because it actually almost knocks him off of his feet. The sheer volume of noise, smoke, and flame,
and the 16 inches aren't even firing.
No,
this is everything up to the 5 inches.
Exactly. Yeah. And this thing just cuts loose with everything she has, so much so that he actually thought he had set the ship afire. To confirm his suspicions, Rear Admiral Kincaid aboard the Enterprise, sends a message via TBS to the North Carolina that just simply asks, are you afire?
Yeah, did something hit you?
Such is the rate of anti-aircraft weaponry and the fire that she is putting out. The ship actually looks like she is aflame. Still, despite the tremendous amount of anti-aircraft fire that is put up by the fleet, including Enterprise herself, which expends something like 1,400 rounds or 14,000 rounds.
14,000, yeah.
Yeah, the Japanese do break through. Vals came down on Enterprise in 7-second intervals, which is an incredibly well-disciplined, well-coordinated dive bomber attack.
By doctrine, right?
And yes. So
they're executing a perfect doctrinal, the purist would say, attack.
These are the guys that are left over from Pearl Harbor, the guys that are left over from Coral Sea, the guys that are left over from Midway. These are still some of the finest naval aviators
in the world.
And they're coming down on Enterprise at 7-second intervals, and they're dropping like a rock. Now, the Val was nothing compared to the SBD, but it was still a damn good dive bomber. In the hands of a good pilot, which all these guys were, you're going to get some hits here and there. Enterprise Captain Arthur Davis is skewing his carrier all over the water as fast as he can, but it's inevitable that Enterprise is going to get hit almost. At 17, 14 hours, a 500-pounder crashes through her flight deck near her after elevator. It punched through 5 decks before exploding, killing 35 men immediately. So this is the first time that Enterprise's flight deck is punctured by a Japanese piece of, you know, munitions here. 30 seconds later, and this will tell you how close everything is, another bomb hits Enterprise only 15 feet away from where the first strike hit. This one's particularly devastating as it explodes in the 5-inch gun gallery. There's some footage of this bomb striking Enterprise that I'm going to show in this in the video version of this podcast that is absolutely horrific. I mean, you can literally see, unfortunately, you can see people just disappear.
Disintegrating.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's horrific. And there's absolutely no way that, you know, maybe if you got knocked overboard, you could survive, assuming you could get picked up in the middle of a battle, which didn't often happen. But yeah, this is an absolute, I think it killed 38 instantly. Yeah.
Instantly kills 38 guys. And what it does is it's a flash fire. You know, the bomb explodes and that kills people there. But then it hits some of the ready ammunition right there, the 5-inch guns that Enterprise had for self-defense, for anti-aircraft defense. Those all go up too. So it's literally like a whoosh. And I mean, and those guys are literally fried at their positions. But Enterprise, like her sister Yorktown, and later like her other sister Hornet, she's a tough old gal, you know. And
Sethism is hard as woodpecker lips. I think I remember you saying something like that.
That is 100% right. Harder than woodpecker lips. She is. I mean, she takes two bombs, boom, boom, and she keeps on trucking. I mean, she barely, you know, if you didn't see the smoke and the flame, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't lose speed. She doesn't lose headway. She doesn't steer out of control yet.
She's on fire.
She is on fire, but she's not dead by any means. She continues to maneuver at high speed despite taking two heavy hits. And she throws up, as I said, over 14,000 rounds of ammunition were fired by Enterprise in that strike alone. Mm. 2 minutes after the first two bombs hit, she's hit a third time up forward. And this hit does minimal damage compared to the other two. Mm. And she's hurt, but she's far from dead. And
now, how many times has Enterprise been severely damaged again at this point in the war?
This is the first time.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the first. You know, she got hit at the Marshall Islands raid. You know, if you remember when the Betty bomber came, you know, cut the tail off of Gato's airplane, and you know, this flame goes off and the plane explodes, and shrapnel does hit the Enterprise, and you know, there was a small fire and people were
minor
killed.
Damage from that one. Yeah,
nothing compared to this. Yeah, this is pretty significant. Not ship threatening hits, but hits all the same. Mm-hmm. So much so that it essentially renders her, she's not useless, but she certainly cannot operate her flight deck at the capacity that she could before she is hit.
Yeah.
At this point, she retires from the area. She gets the hell out of there.
Yeah. She's got to go back to Pearl Harbor for repairs. Now, right. We've said separately that in the whole campaign of Guadalcanal, not in any specific battle, but the entire campaign, somewhere between 3 and 4 times as many sailors died as Marines would die ashore. You know, one Marine is too many, one sailor is too many. But I think, 78 sailors were killed on the Enterprise alone in this battle?
Yes.
Yeah.
78 crewmen are killed on Enterprise. I think a further 90 were wounded. They, you know, she buries her men at sea, and she is forced to retire to Pearl Harbor, mainly because there are no significant repair facilities in the area that can handle the damage that has been done to her.
And that would change later in the war, but for sure. Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard was the place where the closest, and you wanted to go the closest because you want to fix it and turn it around, because we only had those three carriers again.
And you'll see Enterprise again. She's not, like I said, she's not dead. She gets into Pearl Harbor, and it's Admiral Nimitz basically, they hang a sign on the side of the ship on the gangway that says, I forget exactly what the wording is, but it's like number one ship, you know, this is your number one job, or would get it done to get this ship back into service, because
the interesting thing is I spent more time in Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard in my Navy career than I'd like to admit. And their motto to this day is no ka'oi, which means number one, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's what they hung on the Enterprise, was no ka'oi in Hawaiian, meaning number one. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's still displayed prominently in Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard today.
So she makes it back to Pearl in the beginning of September.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's there only a couple of weeks, and they get her the hell out of there.
She's fixed up. Yeah. And they turn around, because she's all got a lot more to do.
Oh, yeah.
Even before the Guadalcanal campaign is completed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Enterprise, you know, I mean, I don't think anybody who's listened to this podcast, I think you could probably tell Enterprise is That's my carrier. As Jig Ramage told me, Jig Dog Ramage told me, she'll always be my carrier. You know, I knew a lot of guys that flew from her flight deck and that lived in the bowels of that ship. And I don't think that the argument could be made to the contrary that she was the most important fighting vessel that sailed the seas of Guadalcanal in 1942 because of what she did.
And of course, her namesake, the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier USS Enterprise, which is now defunct, also was a, you know, iconic aircraft carrier. This is why it's so vital that we get another aircraft carrier named Enterprise to carry on the legacy.
Which I believe they have authorized, if I'm not mistaken. Which is good. It is good. Carry on the tradition. Yep. Carry on the tradition of the Big E. So after Enterprise is hit, now this is late in the afternoon, as I said, this is about 17, well, it's, by the time everything's done, it's about 1745, you know, but everybody collects themselves. So this is late in the day. It is far too late for the Americans to launch, for Fletcher to launch a strike against now where he knows Chicago is or where he thinks he does, because that scout gets back and personally delivers the message that says, hey, I found this thing. It's too late in the damn day. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. And especially now that Enterprise is hurt, you know, he hasn't lost Enterprise and she can still somewhat conduct flight ops, but she can't be an effective offensive carrier at this point. And it's too damn late in the day. These pilots would be attacking probably at night or at the very earliest dusk and returning at night. And it's just going to be a mess. It's going to be a mess. So Fletcher,
We've bloodied the Japanese as we've been bloodied ourselves. And the next day, the Cactus Air Force gets to pick up the fight a little bit. And what happens then?
So it's important to note that, you know, as we said at the beginning of this podcast, that the Japanese are sending the troop convoy out there. This is the second echelon of Ichiki's
people. That's the whole point, right? We're gaining sea control in order to land army forces to take back the island of Guadalcanal.
Exactly.
That's what the Japanese are trying to do.
Exactly. And they're sending these carriers out there to screen that and to attack whatever American forces are out there. Well, the battle has occurred. Nagumo loses Ryuo, and Shikaku is not hit, but she suffers again severe aircrew losses. And at this point, Nagumo says, you know what? He also thinks, by the way, I should add, Nagumo also thinks that he's sunk two American aircraft carriers, which is, I don't understand how, because they only attack one. Right. And she damn sure doesn't sink.
Well, we talked about that during the Midway episode with John Parshall, where he said that they were completely self-delusional, right? Optimistic isn't strong enough, that they had to declare the exchange rate in their favor significantly to satisfy leadership back home.
Yeah.
So, and it's, well, if we lost one, you know, escort carrier, the Americans must have lost two.
That's what he'd like to think.
Can't go any other way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But because of the losses, because of the loss of Ryuo, because of the loss of air crew from Shikaku, he being Nagumo, decides to yet again retire.
Declare victory and retire.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. But what he does, and you alluded to this just a second ago, is they leave that Japanese troop convoy basically to their own devices.
Unprotected.
Unprotected.
Without air cover, I'll say it that way, because they had surface protection.
Absolutely, they did, but they did not have the all-important air umbrella that would shield them, theoretically, from any kind of American attack, be it coming from a flight deck or the unsinkable aircraft carrier on Henderson Field. And that is exactly what happens the following day. Aircraft from Henderson Field, some of which are naval aircraft that were stranded because of this event, called Flight 300. The Japanese are attacked. One destroyer is sunk. Another is damaged. A cruiser is heavily damaged. A transport is sunk, and another or two are damaged, forcing Tanaka, this is the admiral in command of the troop transport convoy, to turn his convoy around and not reinforce the island at that time.
And in fact, to change their tactics, because they're not going to give up. They're going to keep trying to take Guadalcanal back, but they realize, we're going to have to do something different to get those soldiers ashore.
Exactly.
And to fight our Marines.
Right.
And so it had a big impact on the future conduct of this campaign in future battles.
Exactly. And because of this action, because Nagumo turns around and hightails it, and because Tanaka is forced, he was still coming, but this, because of the losses that his task group suffers, he is forced to turn around too. And this, the Battle of Eastern Solomons, is an American victory.
You know, yeah, well, they lost the escort carrier, and how many ships did we lose?
None.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, it both a strategic, because it caused the Japanese to have to change their approach for taking back Guadalcanal, and a tactical, because they lost a major ship. You say it's only an escort carrier. It was a freaking aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. And we lost nothing.
Yeah. And our personnel losses, while, you know, 78 sailors killed aboard Enterprise are significant compared to the Japanese, you know, they're not, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, 43% of their strike force from Shikaku is shot down. You know, we lose 5 combat air patrol. I forget the exact number that Felt loses when he attacks Ryua. I want to say it's like 2. Mm-hmm. It's negligible, you know, considering. Yeah. So
in our Midway episode, you said, and this is why Midway is not the turning point of the Pacific War.
Exactly.
And this, the Battle of Eastern Solomons in itself is not the turning point. No. But now the ship is, the rudder is over, and this enormous vessel is starting to head in the right direction.
You know,
and in aggregation, it becomes the beginning of the turning point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I have a very, very good friend of mine, and I discuss the podcast every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And Sean, hello. And, and we constantly go back and forth as to why Midway and Guadalcanal, or why Guadalcanal is not the turning point, while it is the 20, you know, back and forth.
Yeah. Arguments on both sides.
Exactly. And this is one of the reasons why Guadalcanal, or Midway rather, was not the turning point, because the Japanese can still send this type of force.
A significant force.
Yeah, out to attack what is at sea flying under the American flag.
Go back and listen to the disposition of forces from the beginning of this episode.
It's significant.
They way outgunned us.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And we still won. Yeah. And that's when you start being able to do that kind of thing, you know, the tide is turning.
Well, you'd like to hope.
Yeah.
You'd like to hope. And, you know, this is a victory. This is a clear victory for the United States. Yet it's one of the lesser known battles in 1942. And it's overshadowed by Coral Sea and Midway, for sure. And to an extent, it's overshadowed by Santa Cruz, which we're going to talk about later. But Eastern Solomons was, you know, significant for that period of time. It did not admittedly have long lasting effects that like Midway or Coral Sea or even Santa Cruz, especially Santa Cruz, would have. Because the Japanese do come back, you know, repeatedly, you know, they kind of like a, you know, a bird hitting a window. They just,
right.
You know, just keep coming back at it. Go ahead.
No, what I was going to say is, and I think we've already said a couple of times that Admiral King, Ernest King, CNO Comanche, was, in fact, he was CNO at this point, was not a fan of Fletcher's. Mm-mm. Fletcher keeps being associated with these, you know, victories, and you got to call them that, right?
Of course, well, yeah, and they Midway. Are, yeah.
And yet, you know, he's not long for this world at this point, because the king's going to get his way at some point.
And this is pretty much the last time you'll see Frank Jack Fletcher aboard an aircraft carrier in a major battle in the Pacific War.
Yeah.
And there's multiple reasons. And, you know, we're going to do an episode. We talked about this today. We're going to do an episode with John Parshall again, and we're going to talk about some leadership. Of the leadership.
Yeah.
And we're going to address Frank Jack Fletcher, and we're going to address
leadership at the operational level of war, not at the strategic level.
Right.
Nimitz, we've done it. And King, we've done it. But we're going to talk about the lower level leaders.
Yeah. Guadalcanal area. Yeah.
Including Gormley. Mm-hmm. Before he gets replaced by Halsey. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to unpack here.
There's a ton. And Fletcher, you know, we're going to pay special attention to Fletcher, because I personally, I've said it before, I'm not a fan of the man. I'm not sure he was a nice guy, but I'm not a fan of his record. And yeah, he was a victor at Coral Sea, somewhat victor at Midway, and he definitely was the victor here. Mm-hmm. But there were things that seemingly he let just kind of slip away, you know?
Yeah. And that I think was King's biggest issue with him, was he would, you know, snatch defeat from the mouth of victory. not quite. But
he let things
bad.
Go. He let things go right. away. You know,
he never closed the deal.
Yeah.
In King's mind, at least, he never closed the deal. He was that close to having decisive victory, not just, you know, a victory on the tally board, but a real, no kidding, victory you can't argue with.
Yeah.
And for one reason or another, it's always kind of just beyond his reach.
And this, and a lot of it, you know, specifically here, it's not his fault. You know, I mean, he can't control the radio communications or lack thereof. He can't control that. And you know, Enterprise gets hit. It's not his fault. You know, he had the forces arrayed in such a way where, you know, if everything had been
exchange rate like proves that he did a good job from from the, you know, from the, you know, disposition of forces, you know, and all of that. But
Enterprise King,
still hit.
Yeah, but King, as you said, he clearly was not a fan of Fletcher, and he
pressuring Nimitz to do something.
Yeah, and this is kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back, because to King's eyes, you know, he sees, well, hell, you still got, Enterprise is hurt, but you still have two intact aircraft carriers. Go after these people. And he neglects to do so.
And if we could tease a future episode a little bit here, our friend John Parshall, great World War II historian, thinks Turner is the real goat in this phase of the war, not Fletcher. And that King fired the wrong guy. And it'll be interesting to hear why he thinks that. Stay tuned for that episode where we talk about that. And I say goat, not the greatest of all time.
Yes.
The scapegoat. But the escape, right. The goat, as in the guy who's screwing up.
Yeah. John's got some very pointed comments that I'm sure people are going to want to hear.
And it's hard to argue with him.
Yeah, it is. But well, Bill, I'm good. Do you have anything else you want to?
No, I think we did it.
Yeah, this is a lesser known event in the Guadalcanal campaign. It's probably the least known carrier battle of the war, frankly.
I think so. Yeah.
And yet it's not as important as Santa Cruz that happens 2 months later.
Mm.
But it is still important. You know, that we take out a flight deck. We lose one temporarily. You know, Enterprise is gone for a couple of weeks, but she does come back. And we do draw blood. We do stop the Japanese from reinforcing Guadalcanal at this time.
And we learn from this, right? We learn about communications discipline. We learn about, you know, multi-carrier operations again, which we're doing better here than we did in Coral Sea.
For sure.
Not as good as the Japanese normally do, but we're doing better here.
We don't do as good as the Japanese until 44.
I mean, 44,
We really, really don't.
Yeah.
So, well, with that, we want to thank you very much for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcasts, and give us a rating and review. And thank you to those who have given us a rating and a review. We certainly do appreciate it. Keep them coming. That's how people help. That helps people find our podcast. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called Unauthorized History of the Pacific War Podcast. Also, look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe to our page as well. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. So once again, until next week, I'm Seth Paradin. I want to say thank you.
I'm Bill Todi. And Seth, we have been releasing an episode a week, which is an incredible op tempo, to use the Navy expression. I don't know how long we're going to keep it up, but folks, go back and listen to the earlier episodes. I think you're going to find some really fascinating stuff. If you like this one, go back and listen to the others. In particular, that I'm still intrigued by our Station Hypo episode. And I direct your attention to that one. I think we really uncovered some good stuff there. So, and I'm Bill Todi. Thank you.
Yep. And we're going to see you guys soon. We got a lot more Guadalcanal content coming. So stay tuned. We're just getting started on this bad boy. So
take care.
See you all next week. Thanks.